Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
We have moved on to the second half of Darren Donick and Chase on this beautiful day. Maybe a little shower sprinkled in here and there for some of you today, but the temperature's still manageable to get outside and get that fresh air that we need. Stay healthy. Willie Donick here with you on Darren Donick and Chase. Darren and Chase are off today and tomorrow. They'll be back with us on Monday. So we've got Marquise Munson out around the glass on the other side, co-hosting with me today. Elijah Campbell is producing. He's chiming in as well. So great show so far. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Joe Rexroad from The Athletic wrote a very thought-provoking piece on the legendary sports writer Grantland Rice, Tennessean, Vanderbilt, and then went, nationwide, one of the greatest sports writers of his time. But some complex history as we're examining through different lenses these days. I think you'll enjoy that conversation at 12:30. As we promised you earlier, right now, we talked to Pete Pranica, who I've gotten to know much better over the last few years. He is the television voice for the Memphis Grizzlies on Fox Sports Tennessee. He has done a tremendous job for them. It's been an exciting year for the Grizzlies as they now, hopefully, if everything goes in the right direction, they'll be able to resume play before too long. Pete, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys today?
We're doing great. And so, Pete, I know just like myself, it was all around the same day that the pause button was hit. How have you spent the time here these last few months as we waited out and hope for good things coming around the corner?
Well, trying to stay as busy as possible. Once the golf courses reopened, that became an outlet. I'm a licensed pilot, so doing some real social distancing, going up in a plane by myself and flying around Tennessee. And my mother passed away in February, and so I'm in Wisconsin right now. I'm on my third trip to clear out the house and handle the sale of the property. So even though there's been no NBA basketball, it hasn't exactly been a quiet time for me. There's been enough to keep me busy, but really want to get back. Willie, and I know you do too, you want to get back to really what you love to do, and that's calling, in your case, a hockey game, and in my case, calling the NBA, and hopefully both of us will get our wish real soon.
No doubt, and it's been an exciting year for the Grizzlies. They've got this young nucleus of players that have really sped up a rebuilding process as the team did a really nice job flipping some of their core players and turning it into some excellent assets. So I know the fans for the Grizzlies, Pete, have to be really itching to get this going because they want to see how far these young guys can take this team.
Well, and they're itching to get back in the playoffs, which was not anything I think in the organization really thought, even in their wildest dreams, was possible. But this was a group that came together very, very quickly, and a lot of the credit for that has to go to Taylor Jenkins, who came from the San Antonio system, which is all about family. And one of Taylor's big ways of approaching things is all about, I want my players to know that I care about them as more than basketball players, that I care about them as people. You also had the development of Ja Morant, and we knew that he was an exceptional talent. We knew that coming out of Murray State. I don't think we fully realized how quickly he would become. And the other thing that you don't always see until you really are working with somebody on a day-after-day basis is their intense will to win. And that's what sets apart the great players from the good players in our league and I think any sporting endeavor. There are a lot of guys who play a sport because they're talented and they enjoy it. But then there are some who play the sport because they're talented, they enjoy it, and they absolutely hate losing. And Ja Morant is one of those guys. And when you add him to Jaren Jackson, who has taken a step forward, and Brandon Clark, who is a steal in the draft, you definitely have a young nucleus. And, you have some veteran guys around him like Jonas Valanciunas, who can help out as well. So it's a well-rounded roster, and you're right. I think everybody in Memphis is excited to see what they can do once we get things rolling again.
Well, Pete, as they have announced the format, it's interesting to compare what the NBA is doing to try to, have a fair way of crowning a champion as opposed to the NHL. They've done it a little bit differently, for sure. It's been a little more weighed Whereas teams like the Chicago Blackhawks and Montreal Canadiens, in some people's opinion, got a little bit more life than they should have when they likely were not going to make the playoffs to begin with. So maybe if you can, spell out what the Grizzlies will need to do to get to the playoffs and maybe have a shot to knock somebody off in the playoffs. Because as you mentioned, making the playoffs would be a great achievement based on where the team is right now.
Yeah, I mean, they have a 3.5-game lead, but that lead is over the New Orleans Pelicans. And if the schedule unfolds the way we think that it will, the Grizzlies are going to have two more games against them head-to-head, potentially in Orlando. The other thing that you're looking at is that, you know, it's not only 3.5 games over New Orleans, but there are a couple other teams in the West that are also 3.5 games behind. So you got Portland, New Orleans, and Sacramento are all 3.5 games behind. There are going to be 8 games, as we understand, played. And San Antonio's 4 games back. So all those teams are going to be there. The Grizzlies, and again, if the schedule works out the way we think it will, there will be one more game against San Antonio, 2 against New Orleans, and 1 more against Portland. So a lot of Grizzlies fans were hoping that when the restart occurred that it would simply, well, we're just going to go to the playoffs because the Grizzlies would have been in. Well, they're going to have to earn their way in. But the one curveball that the NBA has added this year is the play-in tournament between the 8th and 9th seeds, which, for those who haven't followed it, the 8th seed will play the 9th seed. If the 8th seed wins the first meeting between those two teams, 8th seed retains the 8th seed, and we start the playoffs. If 8 and 9 play, and in the first game, the 9th seed wins, you got to play another game. And if 9 wins both of those games, they leapfrog and they go into 8. So, you know, there are a lot of things that have to happen. The Grizzlies do have a sizable lead, but they are going to have to face the teams that are directly in their rearview mirror. You know, my point of view is, you know, like I said, the fans wanted the playoffs to start, so they knew the Grizzlies would be in. You know, the Grizzlies are going to have to earn their way in, and I think that's really the fair way to do it, because you have teams that were chasing the Grizzlies, and, you know, you were going to have, and if we had played the full 82-game schedule, there would have been 2 games against Portland. You know, so this gives opportunity to Portland and to Sacramento, who has already won the season series from the Grizzlies, to make a late run and make a push into the playoffs.
We're talking to Pete Pranica. He is the TV analyst for the Grizzlies, and I need your help on this, Pete, because I've been trying my hardest to campaign for Ja Morant to win Rookie of the Year, and obviously I don't have to campaign too much because if you look at his numbers, he's had a great season, but still people bring up the discussion of him and Zion, and possibly Zion could win MVP or Rookie of the Year. Can you help me try to make my case for Ja Morant, being someone who's watched him this entire season?
Well, I think the case for Ja is he's played the entire season.
Exactly.
He held out for a couple of games, had some minor injuries. You're talking about somebody who has taken a team, not entirely by himself, but who has taken a team that has exceeded its projected Vegas win total, that is has a 3.5-game lead, as I said, you know, for the last playoff spot in the West, and has been a starter for every game that he's played, who has been the Western Conference Rookie of the Year, I think, at least 3 times. You look at what he is able to do in the fourth quarter. Last I checked, and, of course, I haven't looked at stats in a while, he was one of the top 5 fourth-quarter scorers in the NBA, not just among rookies, but among everybody. So he's a guy who has produced in the clutch, and you will typically see that start of the game he may be more of a facilitator, but when it comes to winning time, he's the guy. Key block against Kyrie Irving to preserve a tie. Grizzlies go on to win in overtime. Game-winning bucket in Charlotte. You know, the list goes on of the clutch shots that he's made and what he has done. It's been meaningful basketball. It hasn't been just piling up stats. And he has shown that he is a winner, and he is not afraid to take it to the rim late in the game, late in a close game. He's one of the better clutch players in the NBA, and again, that's among all NBA players, not just rookies.
Yeah, Pete, I got to watch Ja Morant. I covered Alabama before coming here, and his breakout game was against Alabama, and then I watched him then and there and knew this kid was a star. When you guys got that second pick of the draft, and you knew the first obviously was going to probably end up going to Zion, and you knew you guys were possibly getting a guy like Ja Morant. What was the reaction of fans out there in Memphis who knew they were getting this guy? And did you guys expect to get this Ja Morant so early in his career?
We knew that he would be exceptional. He would be what I call a generational talent. I think this is a kid who, if the career continues along the uptick, he's going to be a multiple-time All-Star. You know, top end, maybe in the MVP conversation at some point, but would be a guy who is going to be a headliner for the Grizzlies for a number of years. So there was great excitement, you know, on draft night, and there's, you know, and the Grizzlies had pretty much telegraphed, look, we're going to take Morant. So everybody was you know, kind of built up about this, and they were excited about it. He plays with a chip on his shoulder. The Grizzlies, historically, no matter who's worn the uniform, they always play with a chip on their shoulder. It's a small market. It's often overlooked. It just really, really fit. And so fans were excited when he got here. They got more excited the more they saw of him. And his development has really been remarkable. We knew that he'd be good. I don't think we understood he'd be this good this quickly. And the way that he is bonded with his head coach, Taylor Jenkins, and how well they communicate. And the other thing, too, that we didn't really understand when Ja joined us was he has the unique ability to remember plays, and not just plays, but what the other nine guys were doing in that sequence. And he's got great basketball IQ, great recall of where people are on the floor. And I know we talk about a point guard, and it's a cliche, you know, coach on the floor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Morant really can be that. And he's done a wonderful job. And Neil Ivey, who has gone on to be the head coach of the Notre Dame women's basketball team, has been a big influence on him. But we were excited when he showed up. We're even more excited now that we've had a chance to see him through 65 games.
And I want to talk about, Pete, another rookie that's on your team, because I think this was possibly the steal of the draft, and that's Brandon Clark. And he's, to me, been the second best rookie possibly this season, outside of Zion and of course, Ja Morant. But outside of that those tier guys, him and Kendrick Nunn have been like the two most exciting rookies outside of those two. What have you seen from Brandon Clark and you know, his ability to, you know, fit in with this young core so fast and be a, you know, top star with, you know, Jaren Jackson and Ja Morant?
Well, he understands his game. He knows what he can do and do well. He is an excellent pick-and-roll player. He's great finishing as the roll man in pick-and-rolls. He, to me, guys, is the poster child for don't buy into the analytics of the combine. Because, you know, if you look at it, his wingspan isn't really that long. It's probably a little substandard. Who cares? The kid can jump out of the gym. He knows how to play, and the knock on him was, well, can he shoot? Well, you know what? He has the ability to get in the lane, get to the dotted line, and rise above everybody, and he's patented that little floater, and then obviously he can sky and he can dunk as well. So again, it's another kid of high character, played his basketball with a really, really good program at Gonzaga, who was well coached at Gonzaga, comes in, you know, doesn't need the ball to be effective. Very good rebounder, even though he appears to be a little undersized. Again, good basketball IQ, high character, high athletic ability, and just a really, really good person to be around.
Pete, great stuff, as always. We're really excited about what the Grizzlies have done and looking forward to, just like with all the sports, to having some action here very, very soon. And so let's keep our fingers crossed that all goes as smoothly as it possibly can, and I hope you like Orlando. You may be down there for a while. I know you've been there plenty of times before. This could be quite unique, and someday we're going to have some fun stories to tell about all that we experience here coming forward.
Either in Orlando or in a studio in Memphis. We're not really sure how.
That's right.
Play.
Yeah. We're waiting for kind of the same news ourselves here.
Yeah. They may not let us in the bubble. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, if they let you,
we're in the same position.
Well, if they let you in the bubble, hopefully you're good at ping pong and maybe you can compete with someone.
Just don't play doubles.
Just don't play doubles. That's it.
That's right. Pete, we'll talk to you soon. We'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
That's Pete Pranica. He's the TV voice of the Memphis Grizzlies, and he does make a point. We're still, and you know, he works for the same group that I do. In that, and really, this I think goes for all broadcasters. We're still not sure what broadcasters, if any, will actually be on site, because there is an option of keeping that whole group of people in a separate area, calling the games off of a television monitor. That final decision has not been made. At least, obviously, for Pete and for me. I don't know if anybody else privately has decided that, but that remains to be seen. When we come back, we'll talk more about just the uniqueness of Orlando, as we have been reading about. Marquise and Elijah in particular have had some fun looking at some of the details. He mentioned ping pong. That's just the tip of the iceberg there. And don't forget Joe Rexroad coming on at 12:30. Stay tuned. We're coming back with more here on 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. Joe Rexroad coming up at the bottom of the hour. Wrote a very thoughtful piece. He's actually had a number of really good pieces here we're going to touch on. Johnny Majors was the subject of one. Another one was Grantland Rice. And so we're going to get into that at 12:30 with Joe. At 1 o'clock, Elliot Friedman will join us from Hockey Night in Canada. We'll get his take on what's going on with the league. We'll also discuss the NFL and the comments of Dr. Anthony Fauci about some of the challenges facing the NFL and his thoughts on what needs to be done if you're even going to have a season. That's coming up during the 1 o'clock hour. In the meantime, let's talk Orlando, guys. You guys have been studying what some of the protocols are going to be for the NBA and some of the things they've tried to set up to try to keep everybody sane who's going to be in that bubble for a good long time. So Elijah set it up for us.
Yeah, it's incredibly detailed. And that's one thing I will give the NBA is this is a very detailed to the activity kind of plan. I got down 10 of the Bubble City rules that there are at least 30 plus on the Athletic, which did a good job reporting on this. But one is any player can choose not to play, but will have a compensation slightly reduced. And then there's a list of like kind of excused absences, or they're considered protected players. And they have a June 25th deadline to submit their excuse if they live with a loved one who might be susceptible to COVID-19 and owes other extenuating circumstances. An interesting one here, I'll call this the J.R. Smith rule, and that's the only drugs they'll be tested for are PEDs and diuretics. They will not be testing for marijuana and other recreational drugs like that in the bubble down in Orlando. After self-isolation through July 21st, players may eat meals and participate in social activities like ping pong, golf, video games, card games, only with individuals residing within their hotel, provided that they maintain physical distancing. When it comes to card playing, they are not allowed to use the same pack of cards, the same deck of cards, for multiple games. They have to get a fresh pack for each game. Any meal eaten with a player or on another team must be eaten outside. So if Rudy Gobert wants to eat with LeBron James, they got to take that outside. Players are not permitted to enter each other's hotel rooms due to infection concerns. Disney chefs will prepare daily meals, and there will also be a room service option, subject to a few exceptions, and food deliveries from outside of the NBA campus are not permitted. If a player leaves without prior approval, upon reentry, he'll be subject to enhanced testing, including the deep nasal swab test, a 10 to 14 day self-quarantine period, and a reduction in compensation for any game in which he is unable to play as a result of his absence from the NBA campus. Teams will play 3 scrimmage games against other teams residing in their same hotel before the 8-game regular season leading into the 16-team playoffs. So teams like the Lakers and the Clippers and Bucks will scrimmage each other. Pelicans and Grizzlies, same way, because they're all going to be in the same hotel. Agents are not eligible to be there, so there will be no Rich Paul sighting unless he has an adequate disguise, unless that agent is a family member of a player. And of course, the daily entertainment, movie screenings, DJ sets, an interesting one right there, video games, ping pong, singles only, pool, and lawn games. Those are the 10 notable rules that the NBA bubble has kind of set up that I noticed.
Well, Marquise, what jumps out to me is, as Elijah said, it's very detailed. And so there's been a lot of thought put into this. And I guess it's probably not a finished product yet, but there has been a thought not only of safety, number one, but also number two, how do we reasonably keep the players entertained and not feeling too isolated, like they're, you know, that they're confined, right, while they're trying to play these games. They want the experience to be valuable because there is a sacrifice being made, right, when you're restricted like that. And you may be separated from your family in a lot of cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely a lot of your friends.
Absolutely. And there's a lot to do there. I mean, they get to watch movies that don't even come out in theaters. We as the general public can't even watch Black Widow, but yet LeBron James can. LeBron James may not even be a Marvel fan, and guess what? He gets to watch it before we do. But yeah, that's the sacrifice they make, and I think guys are just hungry to play basketball. You know, I think all the amenities is great. It's fantastic. It keeps them entertained for the days that they're not playing games. But like Patrick Beverly says, LeBron says we hooping, we all hooping. And I think that's the mentality that they have, is just they want to play basketball. I can see more people, like, because I think they give you the option of, like, if you want to watch other plays, like other games happen, you can kind of be in the stands and watch other games as well. So I think more players will probably do that than actually some of the amenities that are here. These are, I think, playing cards or eating out with a teammate, or some of these things are more night after game, maybe activities for some of these guys, maybe early in the morning. But I think for the most part, a lot of this stuff is just going to be, look, we're going here to play basketball. And
right.
And a lot of these guys won't even be there long. Hence the
right, but you've got to have some balance.
Absolutely.
In your life, right? So let's take at least for me what I observe. It depends on whether you're like a typical road game, right? Because everybody is basically on the road. You're going back to a hotel in this. So I'm trying to visualize. Let's say you have a game at night, a 7 o'clock game in Orlando. You're playing the opposition. So when you're done, if you are playing a regular road game and you're not flying out that night, what are you going to do? You got to eat. You're very wound up, so you're probably not going to go right back to your room and crash out like you would on a regular day, right? You're wound up, so you know you're typically going to need something to do. So instead of, or you're not going to be able to go to a club, right, or go out to a nice restaurant after the game and, you know, hang out, socialize, whatever. So that is an interesting thing. Like you said, Marquise, it's not as much, you know, the routine. You're going to be practicing. You got your daily routine. It's really after the game in a lot of cases. And you know, what time are you substituting socially? How do you fill that time is going to be a critical thing.
No, absolutely. And there's... I think there's a lot of things that I definitely, if I was in this bubble, I'd be doing. I'd be playing one-on-one ping pong with, with my teammates. You know, I'd be playing. I know they got the VIP lounge that has NBA 2K in it. And I know a lot of NBA players love to play NBA 2K, but a lot of them don't even probably have to play in the lounge. They can play in their hotel rooms with other players that are in the bubble, so they really don't have to use the VIP room. So there's a lot of things here for the players to do. I know that, you know, they rather be with their family. They wish some of their family could enjoy some of these amenities as well. But, you know, in some cases, some guys won't even be there long, so they can get right back to it. To their normal day-to-day lives, and some guys will be there for the long haul. And I think those are the players who are going to get bored easily. LeBron's going to get tired of playing cards with Anthony Davis every day and playing ping pong with Kyle Kuzma. Like, I'm pretty sure that's going to get tiring after a while for the teams that are probably going to go through the long haul of this through October. But you know, for the most part, you know, I think the first months will be, you know, everybody will, you know, get going, wanting to get back into basketball. Some teams will get eliminated. We'll be down to 16. And then as those teams dwindle down, I think the border and border they'll probably get.
Could you imagine the trash talk, though? Because they can go watch other teams' games. Could you imagine if you have, like, maybe 15, 20 players, I guess the trash talk, the entertainment value you can get while two teams are on the floor and, say, or LeBron is playing against the Clippers or whatever, and you have, like, Russell Westbrook, you know, talking junk in the stands or whatever, you're going to get some extra entertainment value because of that. That's probably the most underrated part of this whole plan, is letting other players get to be the crowd for the games that are going on.
Absolutely. I remember Kevin Garnett once, he did that, and it didn't sound too good. We can't play it on air because he used some cuss words. But, yeah, Kevin, it's going to be fun to watch players watch other players and dictate other players.
We'll have to get that dump button ready for sure.
All right, we're out of time for this segment. We come back, Joe Rexroth will join us, and we'll talk about some of his writings lately, some really good stuff. I think you're going to enjoy it. If you haven't read his article in The Athletic about Grantland Rice, on the surface, you're going to say, Grantland Rice, I mean, maybe you know who he is, maybe you don't. But it really gets to a lot of discussion and thought that we're all kind of in this mode right now. Stay tuned. We'll tell you about it when we come back. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. Darren and Chase out for the day. They'll be back with us on Monday. They're on a little vacay. Willie Donick, Marquise Munson, Elijah Campbell here with you on 102.5 The Game. And Joe Rexroth is with us from The Athletic. I read his article this morning on the legacy of Grantland Rice, a famous sports writer who was born in Murfreesboro, attended Vanderbilt, and is most known for some of the writings he did once he left the Nashville area and became sort of a national sports journalist for the ages. And I really didn't even know what the theme of the piece was when I started reading it, Joe. But by the end of it, I was really, thinking of a lot of different things because of what you brought up in the article. Excellent stuff.
Oh, thanks a lot, Willie. I appreciate it. Yeah, this is The Athletic has tried to come up with some different sort of thematic weeks, greatest comebacks. I know one week it was like, write about your sports hero, and we've had movies and all that stuff. So this is media week, and of course, you plan these a few weeks in advance. So I was like, it'd be cool to write about Grantland Rice. He's from Nashville. I don't know that much about him other than what I think a lot of people know. The outlined against the blue-gray sky, the four horsemen, not whether you won or lost, how you played the game, things like that. But didn't really know that much about him. So I read his book, and you go through that book, and there's just a few things in there. You're like, whoa, what was that? And so then I kind of started thinking in terms of, how is someone like that, regarded today? How do you sort of reconcile understanding the time that he was in, but then also still, there's just some things that were obviously okay then that are far from okay now. And then how do you sort of still assess someone? So it was just sort of trying to get at that a little bit. And Robert Meacham, Vanderbilt professor, actually just said something on television that I thought was interesting, and maybe you can apply it to other areas of life beyond, the idea of the Confederate monuments and sort of comparing that to, presidents and founding fathers.
Well, that is something that is being discussed all around the country right now in terms of, whether it be a statue or a chant. I just read where the University of Florida is the Gator Bait chant that we've been hearing for decades. I never even looked into the history of it, but they did, and they're going to discontinue it, right? There's a lot of these discussions going on. So your article was a great prism to look through when it came to Grantland Rice. But you mentioned John Meacham. He gave kind of I think this was a really good way to throw it out there to maybe start a discussion when you're going to have a difficult discussion about something like this, the complexities of history, how do we view it. But he had kind of a line that you draw to, differentiate how somebody from way back when there was a lot different conditions, a lot deeper racism, however you want to label it, times were different, right? In the early 1900s, we don't have the same standards from the 1930s as we do today. We're hoping we've progressed forward and we've got more that we've got to progress. But tell us the terms that John Meacham told you, where he sort of divides the line when you look back through history.
Yeah, and by the way, thank you. Did I say Robert Meacham? I may have, and I apologize. That's a former NFL receiver, so sorry about that. Yeah, thank you for the correction. Yeah, well, John Meacham, and actually, I will tell you, you know, for this story, I got to give credit to Dan Wolkin. Now, Dan Wolkin is one of several people you and I know, a lot of them, who went to Vanderbilt on the Russell Rice scholarship, which is for people interested in sports writing. You know, Andrew Marinus, Mitch Light. You go back to Roy Blunt Jr. and Skip Bayless.
We had Tyler Kepner on this morning, another one of them. So just another example. So many. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was the one, he said, actually, it's funny because I just saw this thing from John Meacham, and it's kind of I'd never thought of it that way. So I went and looked it up online. I was like, that's really, like, I liked, basically what he was saying was, because a lot of people are saying, oh, we're going to tear these Confederate monuments. Oh, so what's next? The Washington Monument, the Jefferson Monument. You know, these are monuments that these people own slaves. I mean, you know, do you just erase all the history? And his point was, you know, if you were committed to, you know, a greater union, then that's a distinguishing factor. You know, if you were still for the Constitution and for, you know, which of course eventually added the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, Civil Rights Act, all these things. You know, even if you didn't believe all that stuff at the time, you still believed in the Constitution and the idea of equality and moving towards something. You know, you can contrast that with, you know, someone from the Confederacy who actually declared war on the United States and was for, you know, essentially abandoning the Constitution. That's one thing. And, of course, another thing he brought up, and I think when we talk about the Nathan Bedford Forrest debate, Willie, I mean, that thing went up in 1978. This is not some
not 1878, 1978. Right. You do look at it differently when you know that. I wonder how many people knew that. That was eye-opening for me.
So what is that? I mean, to me, it's like, okay, so we're starting to have some civil rights in this country, and now you put this bust up of, sure, a great Confederate general, also the first Grand Wizard of the KKK, also someone who oversaw the slaughter of more than 300 black Union troops who were trying to surrender in the Civil War, probably the one of the most disgusting acts ever, you know, perpetrated in the Civil War. So why was that put up in 1978? Why are we cherishing that as some historical relic that we can't tear? That was, to me, that's, I think, you know, the motivations for even having that up are very questionable. So that was his distinguishing factor. So can you take that to other walks of life, sports writing, you know, journalism, anything? You know, I think with Grantland Rice, you know, what I found in his book, there were some very racist beliefs and phrases in the book. It was also a general idea that it's good that, you know, Jackie Robinson happened. You know, he talked about Satchel Paige. What could he have done? I think some of his views for that time were probably largely rejected by a lot of his readers, too. So I think the overall feeling and, you know, belief that you got from him was that this was progress, this was good, there should be integration in sports. And I think you have to try to, you know, take that into account as well. And again, it just, if you're going to celebrate and look at people from different eras, I think you do have to look at the warts and everything.
Right. I think that was, it came through in the piece, which I think you said it really well, Joe, and I hope as we have these conversations, and right now this is an opportunity that we're all trying to take advantage of, where we're examining these things, where life is at a little bit of a slower pace, especially for all of us that are waiting for the next contest to go on the field or on the court or on the ice. But where you can't, there is a complexity to it, as you just mentioned with Grantland Rice. You had some great quotes from him. You had some things that really warm your heart about race relations. And then you point out some other specific things that he wrote that would definitely make you cringe. But then you try to look at it. What was the context of the time and stuff like that? So it's nuanced. It's complex. It's not a simple thing, but it's something that hopefully we can all look at as we try to collectively move forward here.
Yeah. And one area, you know, Grantland Rice, I would say he was out front on women in sports. And of course, again, people have to think back early 1900s. That was just not a thing, you know, and Grantland Rice, in fact, you know, reading a book about him by Charles Fountain, you know, there was very little attention given to Babe Didrikson. And of course, he later became Babe Didrikson Zaharias, one of the greatest athletes of all time, period. I mean, you're talking about someone who won the Olympics, won gold in all these events, became an all-time great golfer. I mean, truly an all-time athlete. He wrote extensively about her and celebrated her and wrote about her just as he wrote about any other athlete. His peers largely ignored her. And at times, and I put in a line from Paul Gallico in the piece to kind of contrast some of the stuff he wrote versus some of his peers, you know, just totally, just awful disrespect of a woman's athlete at the time. So, you know, you take that into account, too. I think in that area, he certainly stood out as a progressive compared to his peers, and probably in terms of race, not as much so, but still, I mean, as Fountain said, and I quoted him, I mean, everyone at the time was a bigot. Now, of course, everyone couldn't have been, or else there would have never been any progress, but that was mainstream thinking.
We're talking to Joe Rexroad of The Athletic. Now, Joe, you know, when doing the reporting on this, is there something that you kind of took away from this in your own journalism and looking back at how he reported things, and you kind of studied this and looked at it and was like, hey, I didn't know that about this, about, you know, Grantland Rice?
Well, yeah, Marquise, and actually my initial idea for this was comparing access then to today, until I started, you know, I read the whole thing and I was like, okay, well, this is something that I think is more important. But the access stuff is incredible, and that's where, you know, obviously we'll never go back to that. It's just hard to even imagine. Basically, he made more than everyone he covered, first of all. He made like $1.5 million if you put in today's dollars in the 20s. You know, he's out buying like a place on the ocean in the Hamptons, you know. And so, like, you know, celebrity athletes sought him out. I mean, seriously, the most amazing thing to me is the Newt Rockne thing. He invites Newt over to his house to drink the night before the Notre Dame Army game, and Newt's like, you know, I've got this speech about the Gipper, and he died 8 years ago, and I think we're going to get killed tomorrow. I might bust out this speech. George Gipp told me, you know, I should say this speech sometime to a team, and I get Grant like, yeah, go for it. You know, so like, he knew about the Gipper speech before it happened, you know, and all kinds of stuff like that, where he's in the hotel room with Babe Ruth the day before the called shot in the World Series. Or, I mean, you know, it was very much that, you know, journalists and athletes, one, they were much more friends and, you know, allies than, of course, today. I mean, I think, and of course, you could look at that and talk about, we talked today about people who are homers. I mean, my goodness, you know, back then, I mean, it's basically like you're on the team playing, on the team train, playing cards and cheering on the boys, you know. I mean, it's very different, but also just the celebrity and the, you know, the money and all that stuff. I mean, it was just, he was at the forefront of really a new industry. And I mean, even spectator sports, when he got into the business, were new, you know, and becoming a thing. So it really is an amazing career.
Is there a relationship that he had that kind of shocked you, like kind of brought you by surprise? Because I'm saying, like, man, he had a relationship with Joe Louis. Like, I want to hang out with Joe Louis. I want to be valued friends with Joe Louis. So is there, like, a relationship that he had that kind of surprised you a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, honestly, I'll tell you, like, Ty Cobb, and that's the thing. You think about Joe Louis, and it's like, you know, that's cool. He was friends with Joe Louis. Apparently, they you know, had a long friendship. I actually reached out to Joe Louis's son for this, but he was just like, yeah, I was so young. I mean, I know my dad, you know, was definitely a good friend of his, but he couldn't, you know, he didn't have a lot of information about it. But, you know, he was also super close with Ty Cobb. Now, of course, Ty Cobb is very well known for being very racist, you know, and Ty Cobb, I mean, that's part of his legacy, along with just, you know, his nastiness on the field and all that stuff, along with being, you know, one of the greatest hitters of all time. But, you know, you think about that, too, and, like, how certain people thought, and you're friends with different kinds of people in there, and how did that all work? But honestly, you know, on the writing side of it, you know, it's like Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, I mean, they were all in New York at this time in the early 20th century, sort of this group of people who, you know, we still talk about 100 years later.
Yeah, and it's kind of, and I was going to ask you, Joe, what is your approach when it comes to, you know, writing and talking about kind of like those race relations? Because, you know, obviously we're in a different time and we're in a different era now, so a lot of these conversations are a little bit more open now, but you still have the occasional people that want to say, well, stick to sports, you know, but a lot of times, a lot of these things, as we're seeing now, has to do with sports. So what has always been your approach to kind of how to report and on these things that involve sports and race relations?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's always been a part of sports, and I think it's important moving forward. Like the Gatorade thing Willie just mentioned, I had no idea. And then I read up on it, and it was just horrifying to see the history of that term. So a lot of people may say, well, I didn't know that, and I like saying that, and why can't we keep saying it at the games? And it's like, well, but now you know the history, so no, you shouldn't still say it, you know? And there's some comments on my story like, oh, we're just going to cancel and erase everyone and just erase our history. And I replied, no, I'm not trying to erase Grantland Rice. I'm saying, though, that we should have a complete history and recognize the flaws and warts and understand why and understand the context of the time. It's complicated. It is nuanced. It's not easy. But I think, Marquise, you know, that discussion, I mean, you think about, you know, over time, think about Muhammad Ali and how he was perceived then and now how he's perceived, you know, and Joe Louis in a different way. But Muhammad Ali, of course, for, you know, for Vietnam and all that stuff. And Colin Kaepernick now is somebody. It'll be really interesting to see how he is regarded by history 20, 50 years from now. I bet you it's a lot different than what a lot of people were saying in 2016. So I think it's always been a part of sports. It always will be. And I think we've got to take these things on and talk about them clearly and you know, with full context and not leave anything out. I think that's really important.
And Joe, before, you know, we got to let you go soon, but before we have to talk about your Johnny Majors article that was pretty big as well. I got a notification. I was like, Johnny Majors article. Wonder who wrote this. Is it David Upton? No, it was Joe Rex wrote. And I was like, definitely going to read this. And, you know, definitely, you know, a lot of interesting stories and pieces in that. So, and one thing that always intrigued me, because, you know, obviously I don't know. I wasn't raised in the Johnny Majors era. And it's kind of sad that the only thing that I know about Johnny Majors and the first thing that comes to my mind about Johnny Majors is, you know, his issues with, you know, who. So it's just like, that's the thing that I come up with when I speak about, you know, Majors is, you know, talking about Phil Fulmer and his issues with him. But for someone like me and for someone who wrote a piece like that about Johnny Majors, what would you tell me to look up with when it comes to Johnny Majors?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, that was a piece a long time in the coming, and I would say for that, I read his book, which was written with Ben Bird, by the way, Rick Bird's late father, who, of course, covered Johnny's tenure in Knoxville. You Can Go Home Again. That's from 1986, so it's more of the early days of Tennessee. But, yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line with Johnny Majors, it's obviously sad he passed away, and honestly, I had no idea talking to him for hours the week before he passed away that, you know, I mean, he said he was doing well, and he was great that week talking about it. It's pretty amazing that he passed away peacefully looking out on the Tennessee River. But if you look at Johnny Majors, I think he was the greatest living legend of Tennessee football. And I think when the history – you start with General Nealon, and then you go to Johnny Majors next as a player, you know, second in the Heisman, two-time SEC Player of the Year, but then also as a coach. I think he's a clear two, and I think the Majors family, which I wrote a lot about in this piece, clearly the first family of football in this state. So I learned a lot from it, and you're right. I think everybody thinks of the same thing, Marquise. You think of Fulmer Majors, but there is a lot more to the story.
Joe, great stuff. I hope a lot of people check out both of those pieces, and also your piece on John Ward and what it's like to succeed a legendary sportscaster. That's a good one, too. So, kudos to all you guys at The Athletic. I know this has been a challenging time. We read about, I know they laid some people off, including our good buddy John Glennon, but you guys have met the challenge really well with how to get stimulating sports writing done during this time when there's no games.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And yeah, miss John every day, but we're doing our best in this time and really appreciate you guys having me on. Thanks a lot.
All right, sounds good. John,
appreciate you, Joe.
Joe Rexrode with The Athletic. And so I'm looking at a text. You guys, my phone just buzzed. I got a little distracted there. Tell me what we need to do, because I know we have Elliot Friedman coming up at the top of the hour.
Well, we could just talk here for a little bit and then break and then go to Elliot.
All right. So
but what Joe was mentioning and what you mentioned like towards the end of that interview is basically there's been a lot of great journalism that's come out, stories that, you know, we probably would have never did if we had sports around this time. I know nothing about Grantland Rice, you know, and I read the article and now I feel like I know. But I know nothing about it because I'm not from Nashville. So, you know, learning these different stories and obviously the Johnny Major story, like I know my bits and pieces about Johnny Majors, but not to in depth of what Joe had in his article. And I think this has been a perfect time to get some of these stories out that we never really talk about because we always have sports going on and we always have something to talk about. And now that we don't, we've had to kind of dig in some of these stories. And I think that's awesome.
Oh, I've loved it. That's like the only thing about, you know, not having sports is that you get to catch up on things like that. And for anyone listening, if you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, I highly recommend it just because this is the kind of stuff you get even when it is a slow sports period. I haven't got to read the Grantland Rice piece yet, but I do remember like in journalism school, which I'm only a couple months removed from, with a lot of Grantland Rice discussion, and it's good education, you know, for anyone who even wants to cover. It's a good, The Athletic has a lot of good examples to go off of, and the good story ideas too. I mean, they've been as good as it gets in terms of coming up with story ideas in a time where there really isn't any sports going on.
Well, we can go down the list of discussions that people are having on how to, in our mind, come to a resolution on where to place, you know, things in history, right? And the complexity of it. This is a great time to do it from a sports perspective. But, you know, as we mentioned, the Gatorade chant, if you've ever been to a game with Florida involved, you've heard that chant, right? And you've never, I had no idea, but they're looking into that now. Would they be doing that if we weren't in the situation we're in? Probably not. But I like the fact that we're reexamining these things and taking a look and, how do we place all these things when it comes to statues and chants and historical significance for a lot of different things? But I thought Joe's article really gave us a good compass there to sort of look at, start a discussion. How many times, Marquise, have we been talking about this in the last few weeks? Is we need to have some conversations, right? We need to have conversations where people are coming at it with different views. Right, but have a real meaningful conversation where it's not arguing back and forth and what about this and what about that and having absolutes, right? There's different layers to it, and this kind of stuff really helps, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about listening, and we've been promoting listening and learning. Like, you know, I want to talk to someone of the opposite of me to learn how they think and their thought process throughout everything that's going on, and vice versa. They can hear from me, and then we kind of share stories, share ideas, and kind of figure out a common ground. I've had many of conversations in the last couple weeks, one-on-one, group, you know, whoever, and I'm more than willing to have those conversations with people. But I think there's so many people out here that are scared of those uncomfortable conversations that they try to run away from it, and you can't do that. Like, those conversations need to be had because, you know, obviously if you're oblivious to something, the only way to learn is by asking questions and asking questions to the right people and talking to the right people about it. So I think once we get to that common ground, we can move this country and move everything else forward.
And I think it's important, a theme of, and again, the article is called How He Played the Game, Assessing the Complicated Legacy of Grantland Rice. And listen, Grantland Rice is a Vanderbilt guy. I have been reading about Grantland Rice. I know, as Joe pointed out, so many of the scholarship winners of that award who went to Vanderbilt, I went to Vanderbilt with because of that scholarship that afforded the opportunity to those guys. But I've never read about some of the history here. But I think it's important to try to figure out, you know, if somebody did write something that was racist at the time, or it still is racist today, like Grantland Rice did, you know, is that an automatic disqualifier? It shouldn't be, right? You have to look at everything, right? And then what is over the line that we have to, that really maybe does change your view of the legacy? It is nuanced. It is not simple. And that's why it takes detailed discussion and detailed thought to try to place it in the right place.
I always see growth in people. Like, you know, who Marquise Munson was 10 years ago is not Marquise Munson almost 30 years old. Like, there, it's always a progression. It's always growth. It's always you learn different things by different experiences and different conversations you had. I may have said something at, you know, 14, 13 that I, you know, I regret at the age of 30. And, you know, but that's, you know, I don't want people to judge something based off of what I said when I was 13. You know, I want people to judge the person that I am now and judge the person that I learned from that mistake. But I think sometimes we get into a situation to where, you know, the only time guys really want to do be, you know, grow and have growth is when they get called out for it. And no, we shouldn't have growth because we get called out about it and we got caught. We should have growth because, you know, that's what we do as a human, as, you know, everyday years, as we get older, let's just grow every year. So, you know, and I think once we do that, I think we live in a better society when people just learn how to just grow and move forward with things and move stuff in the past and then focusing on the future.
Good stuff. It ties into what we were talking about with Tony Kemp yesterday, the plus one effect that he's trying to get out. Just that mindset of listening to other people, rubbing off on somebody, looking things in a different way. That's how we progress. If you can get one person to do that, and that person gets one person to do that, we're going to make some progress.
And we're going we're probably going to disagree on things, but let's just create dialogue. Let's just create dialogue. Let's learn. You know, and give me a reason. Have a rebuttal for why you disagree with me, and let's have a conversation and create dialogue instead of just saying, "Nah, I disagree with you, so I'm not going to listen to anything else you got to say."
I hear you. When we come back, Elliot Friedman will join us. We'll talk NHL. Stay tuned. We're coming back here on Darren Donick and Chase.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase